Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Antifada. Sean here with Andy, of course. We're talking today with Anselm Yapi, a professor of philosophy and a member of the Crisis Group, about his new book, The Self-Devouring Society, Capitalism, Narcissism, and Self-Destruction. And we're also with Eric John Russell, an old friend of the show, who has translated the book to English for Common Notions Press. The book's tagline is, "Everybody can feel that the world is getting angrier. The self-devouring society provides an original and rigorous explanation of why." So Anselm, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yes, thank you too, but I have to declare immediately, I am no longer a member of the Crisis Group since the Crisis Group split 20 years ago in 2004.
Ex-member of the Crisis.
So I did no longer write. It's true that it's the origin of the critic of value, but it doesn't exist nearly anymore as a magazine.
Well, I think a lot of our listeners will appreciate that you were involved in the Crisis Group.
Yes.
And I think they'll appreciate this book, too. It's a very clear and interesting theory on, I think the biggest value of the book for me is the question of these mass shootings and random acts of violence that you generally put under the umbrella of running amok that gets away from this sort of really disgusting way of looking at those events where you're trying to look at the motive. And if the motive fits your worldview of like who the evil enemy is, whether they be Nazis or ISIS or leftists or whoever, you put things into that camp and you see the criticism of value and psychoanalysis to find a commonality between these events that I thought was really valuable.
Yes, so I have to explain first that this book, which has been published in French in 2017, is the continuation of my preceding book, The Adventures of the Commodity, which has been published in French in 2004, and which has been published in the same moment, that means in the fall of last year, by Bloomsbury in an English version, but unfortunately a very expensive one. So in the Adventures of Commodity, I mainly referred to Marx and to his critique of political economy and explaining the main thought of the critique of value. I tried to show the principal issues of contemporary capitalist society, especially in categories with which you could of collective living, what might be called political and economical side. In this book, I planned to name The Adventures of the Subject. I wanted also to show the subjective side of the society dominated by the abstract side of labor, by the commodity, by money, and by value. But in this context, I also referred especially to Freud's theory of narcissism and to the lack of boundaries. So I also wanted to show in which way contemporary psychology is very different from the psychic structures which accompanied capitalism until the first half of the 20th century. On the other hand, I also refer to some aspects of contemporary sociology, as for example some studies about the school shootings and mass murders. But I have to say this is not the principal subject of the book.
Sure, for me that was something that the way you put it in chapter 4 really gave me a new way of thinking about these events that, of course, happen all the time. I mean, we just saw what appears to be a massive ISIS attack in Moscow. And I'm sure by the time this episode comes out, we'll see a new example of a disturbing mass shooting that we have to think about and have some frame of reference for. So this book helps with that.
Yes, also because I tried to show that these are not individual phenomena, but that they are linked especially to the narcissistic structure and narcissistic regression of personality. And also to the enormous role of resentment as the prevailing form of social feeling today, a kind of hatred against the whole world, which does not which does not at all try to find the real causes of the misery of the individuals, but of general hate against the whole world, which can be directed against very different targets. And this is also the consequence of the fact that in the contemporary capitalist society, in many individuals, the psychic development stops very early and also remains at the level of what could be called narcissism. And I also have to say that another main inspiration for my book was Christopher Lasch, especially his two books about narcissism and the minimal self.
Christopher Lasch has been having a bit of a moment. So there has been this resurgence of discussion about theories of narcissism developed by Christopher Lasch. Why do you think narcissism has become a popular category of political discussion? And do you think that Lasch and the Laschians are on the right track?
Because since in the heydays of capitalism, and it means especially around 1900, it was when also Freud discovered that neurosis has also an origin in the conditions of living. It is mainly linked to the repression of drives and of individual desires. The repression of desires leads to some kind of repression and also to some kind of substitute actions. But that also means to stay with some form of control. But what has happened, especially when the center of capitalism shifted from the production to the consumption, especially in the second half of the 20th century, so the self-control, which was before at the center of the society, organized around work and saving, the center now was more and more shift towards some kind of fake self-realization. That means especially to fulfill all one's own will on yielding to all the seductions of consumption. This is one of the reasons why people more and more have difficulties also in restraining their own desires. So this is more or less the contrary of traditional neurosis, but there is nothing, there is no kind of liberation. A kind of desublimation, repressive desublimation, as Herbert Marcuse calls it, which is also another one of my inspirations.
Well, let's turn it over to Eric John for a second. How did you get involved in the book, and what do you think the value of this book is?
Yeah, so Anselm and I were approached by the publisher themselves to translate this. Andy Battle brought it to our attention. I mean, Andy had an eye on it. And he wrote to us asking, okay, can you tell me a little bit more what this book is about? Because we might be interested in publishing it, and we'll apply for a grant to
get with Common Notions Press.
Common Notions Press, exactly. And here was an American publisher willing to pay for translation. So it was quite remarkable of a situation generally. And then my own personal thinking on the matter was, okay, yeah, it's true that since the 70s, right, you get a lot of right self-help therapeutic discourse on ideas of narcissism, especially in the post, let's say, Trump period. You get discussions of narcissistic individuals, right, in the daily press, discussions related to that of demagoguery. And it seemed that, a lot of these psychoanalytic terms for understanding political phenomena really didn't have the sort of conceptual precision that might be necessary if, in fact, they are to be helpful at all for explaining our contemporary moment. So here comes a book, right, that sort of returns to the question of, you know, what's the relation between Freud and Marx, and what is some way in which we can employ some psychoanalytic categories with a little bit more precision to just sort of clear a path for, you know, rendering something like psychoanalysis important and, in fact, structurally close to the critique of political economy. And I take that to be sort of the central benefit and thesis of the book, that is establishing some kind of theory of subjectivity, some kind of psychic structure adequate to the forms of value and the sort of indifference and abstract nature of the forms of value that establishes a form of psychic subjectivity adequate to that kind of social organization. I mean, this is the main thesis of the book. Narcissism ends up being quite important of a phenomena, even though it's it can be interpreted, you know, many different ways. And to Anselm's credit, he goes through in chapter two specifically a very, very nice kind of intellectual history of interpreting the concept, the debates within the Frankfurt School on different ways of interpreting Freud. And so, you know, we do get a multivalent, you know, conceptual sort of exploration of the concept of narcissism. And that does a lot already, right? That's already doing a lot for a moment in which, right, it seems very easy for people to throw out these concepts and categories without giving them much reflection. And if an analysis can do that while at the same time, right, grounding itself within the specificity of capitalist social forms, then yeah, this is going to be a very, very, very valuable book to have in English. So that was kind of my incentive.
Yes, it was also important to me to really recall to the left all the changes capitalism has undergone in the last decades, since I think that many people until today on the left stay with the idea that capitalism is necessarily something reactionary or conservative, which only asks to people to bow their head, to work, to save, to abide to laws, and so. This naturally is partly continues to be true, but capitalism also in the last decades very often speaks in the name of the liberation of individuals. And I think this kind of, let's call it progressive side, negatively progressive side of capitalism is often not really perceived by critical discourses about capitalism. And that also means that we also have to say that many instances of liberation of the individual, for example, 70s was, for example, sexual liberation, finally also served the rise of a new form of capitalism, which especially is based on consumption and also, for example, which does not speak more about saving, but especially about debt, for example, as a central aspect. But I also have to say that I published the book, now it is already 6 years ago. It is true that the openly reactionary side of capitalism had a kind of backlash in this last year. So I wrote this book before, for example, the era of Trump. It is also true that this kind of, let's say, apparently gentle side of capitalism, which Christopher Lesch describes, was not capitalism's last words. Now it is also sometimes on the defense against the kind of old-fashioned version of capitalism.
Sure, yeah. So your book is framed around the myth of, and I hope I can pronounce this, Ariskaton. Can you summarize this this myth, this story, and what its relation is to your project?
Yes, so it was quite a discovery when I many years ago I visited him in Rome and I saw a picture with a strange scene, and there was an explanation about that this picture from the, I think the 16th or 17th century explained the myth of, I don't know how do you say in English, Ariskaton. So I got quite intrigued and I got some information about this picture. I also have maybe to tell this anecdote. I tried a lot to now which was the picture, but I went to the catalog of the museum and I never found out which was the picture, since I would have liked it to use it also for the cover of the book. And this also gave me as a strange association that the thing that this picture seems to have vanished from the earth sometimes reminds me about my, maybe you find this association very strange. I like one of my favorite books are The Confessions of an English Opium Eater by De Quincey. Maybe you remember he buys his first opium in a pharmacy in London, and when he wants to return, he finds that the family has disappeared, and he never could find out what has become that pharmacy. So what struck me really in the kind in this myth about the history, which is called mainly by Ovidum, but which is much older, about the king of the mythical times, who wants to cut a tree which is sacred to the goddess of harvest, to Demeter and to her followers. And so he wants to cut it to construct his palace. But the goddess shows herself and tell him not to do so, since it would be sacrilege. But he doesn't obey. And when his servants even refuse to cut the tree, he kills some of the servants and he cuts himself the tree, even if blood is going out of the tree. And so he constructs his palace for his feasts. But as always in Greek myth, the hubris, it means the arrogance against the divine, is punished in a very original way. And it means he becomes always hungry, and he can eat as much as you find. Absolutely nothing is able to satisfy his hunger. So he continues to eat, and he eats everything he finds in his country. And he even sells his daughter to prostitute herself in order to eat what she gains with her money. But nothing is sufficient. He finally ends up eating himself, which is the origin of the name, the self-devouring society. And I found that this myth is really, really a very extraordinary metaphor of the psychic structure in capitalism. It is a desire of something which is no more a desire of something concrete, but it is an abstract hunger, and hunger which cannot absolutely be fulfilled by nothing, as is the desire for money. And several details which you find in this history which struck me. For example, there is the violence against nature. There's the violence against the first people, since this tree is sacred to the original people of that region. There's the violence against people as his servants who do not want to collaborate in his crime. And finally, there is also the violence, especially against women. In that case, his own daughter. Which he sells, as in the histories we know about people who send the women to prostitute themselves in order to buy drugs. It's very close to the logic of drug. As much as the king consumes it, it is never enough. Then, hence his hunger is a hunger which can never find satisfaction. And this is what really characterizes the narcissistic personality. It is not a hunger for something material or concrete or for some real affection, but it is just a desire to take hold of the whole world. The narcissistic personality can never find satisfaction in the world, since he cannot really establish what in psychoanalysis is called a real object relation. He's always only relation to him or herself. So that also means there can never be a satisfaction. And this useless quest for satisfaction finally leads to destruction, and in the case of the king, to self-destruction.
Now, the theory also reminds me of this concept of social cannibalism. Have you heard this term? I think it comes from the Greek autonomist milieu as a way of referring to elements of the working class that might be called the lumpenproletariat that's engaged in various antisocial, like mafia type activities. But in general, I think the way that you describe narcissism is you're not talking about like a clinically defined personality disorder as much as you're talking about a sort of general crisis of subjectivity in late capitalism or neoliberal capitalism. At one point, you call it a anthropological rupture. So, you know, when we're talking about narcissism, we're not specifically talking about individuals who are narcissistic, or are we talking about both the individual problem of narcissism or like a sort of general narcissism that's descended upon social reality?
That also means this kind of narcissism is something which you can find in all social groups and classes. Naturally, it might be stronger naturally in the ruling classes, but it is something which you can find in all over the society. And which also informs the reactions of the victims of the system. As I say, these reactions tend more and more to become a kind of blind violence, as in the classical school shooting, but also naturally, for example, the kind of Islamic terrorism. There can also be the same kind of psychological mechanism. That means, on the one hand, individuals which have no consideration for themselves, but before leaving the world, before suiciding themselves, they want also to take as much people with them as possible. So that is also interesting in the analysis of all these kind of mass murders, with or without political or ideological explanation, that normally it is a kind of what is called enlarged suicide. It is a kind But it is also linked, especially in the kind of individuals, it is also very much linked to very isolated people who live mainly being on in the web. And so this kind of anthropological rupture is also very much linked to the digital world and to this kind of desubstantialization of the world. So people are always less in contact with material things or with human feelings of the others, but only with representations. And with things or people just reduced to algorithms.
Yeah, let's try to marry this with your work with crisis and on value theory. So you approach this conception of narcissism through value criticism and the theory that commodity society throws the subject form into crisis. What's the relation? Can you outline this process, this relationship between value critique and narcissism?
Yes, this is maybe even the central subject, even if it is not the most easy to explain.
Thankfully, our listeners should have a passing familiarity with value theory. If we've done our work well, they will.
The link is more or less the idea of something empty or void, because since when Marx analyzes value is not the use value. Economical value is something which has no content. It is a result. It is a representation of what Marx calls the abstract side of labor. That means all labor, every kind of labor, material or not material, is always a kind of depends of energy, of human energy measured by time. That means that abstract labor has no specific content. It can be agriculture, it can be production of bombs, it can be radio broadcasting. As to the abstract side, all labors are equal, are the same thing, all a quantity. And this is a big difference between capitalism and preceding social formation. So what is typical to capitalism is not so much exploitation or domination, which also existed in other societies, but preceding societies were oriented about something concrete. For example, the feudal laws, they wanted to have a part of the harvest, for example, of the peasants in order to have themselves a luxurious life. But in capitalism, the reproduction of value is made by the reproduction of abstract labor. It's a multiplication which expresses itself in the multiplication of money, which also has no special content, because if money is used, for example, for individual consumption, it is already something which is out of capitalist logic. Capitalist logic demands to reinvest the money in a bigger sum of money. That also means that on a logical level, capitalism does not aim at satisfy any needs, not even the needs of the ruling classes, but it is a kind of what you can call it tautological. It is a kind of machine which feeds itself all the time. It's the only aim of growing always more. That every content for the capitalist can be changed for another one. In this kind of indifference to all content characterizes the capitalist logic. You find it also in the narcissistic logic for the narcissistic personality. It exists only in the world, or the surrounding world, of what is called objects in psychoanalysis, exists only as a kind of projections for the narcissistic personality. That means there is no proper quality in the world. All the world is reduced to a kind of, as I said, of individual projections. And that is also mean this kind of absence of content, this kind of always reducing everything to the same is on the deepest level, I think, what links narcissism to the capitalistic logic of value.
We talked about the neoliberal era, or like the post-68 era, and the way work has sort of evolved in this period for a lot of people is that they have to do multiple jobs at once. They have to always be on the clock. There has to be a certain flexibility to their schedule, to their general approach to their working life. So you've get to the point where your entire life is reduced to this question of value, right? You see this as you link this to narcissism, and then you link it towards a generalized death drive. Can you kind of help walk us through this? How do we go from the neoliberal period to a narcissistic death drive? What does the death drive mean?
Yes, naturally, we should always remember neoliberalism is not the bad side of capitalism against the Fordist or Keynesian capitalism, which would be the good capitalism. Neoliberalism is just the continuation and the exasperation of the basic structure of capitalism. And it is especially, it is the higher state of capitalism in the sense that naturally the logic of value first existed in the sphere of production especially. And when it developed a kind of imperialism, the whole life became subject to the main logic of preparing themselves for the work, especially. Not only the time of your life which you sell for work, but your whole life now has to turn around labor. The people you see, your family life, your cultural consumption, for example, the music, the like, the clothes you wore, and so all this is often put on the service, for example, of finding a better job or of getting to know the right people to higher climb the ladder in the world of flexibility. And so that means that the empty and non-human logic of value, maybe until the 60s, could be more or less balanced, for example, by another sphere, like, for example, family life, friendships, neighborhood, which did not obey completely to the same logic, and which could be lived as a kind of rest. But these spaces are reduced always more by that kind of always devouring logic of capitalism, and that means which we have completely to live now to impose ourselves in the society of everlasting competition. And it's also that can, on the one hand, can lead, especially in a part of individuals, to a kind of death wish in a life which have no proper content, which seems only to exist in the fulfill requirements which comes from society, can also make feel many individuals that their life is completely useless. That's also what you see, especially in this kind of individual school shootings, also in the testaments, which often people register before they act. They often speak about their complete about a life that without pleasure, without use, from which you want to part, but not alone. On the other hand, naturally, this death drive, you can also find it on a social level, on a more logical level, is a kind of self-destruction of the whole system. The whole capitalist system is, as we see every day, running against the wall, especially on an ecological level, but also by the new wars and so on. And that means capitalism is no longer in a kind of conquest, yes, but the kind of self-destructive conquest. For example, commercializing always more aspects of human life, for example, what now is called the care industry, for example, by getting, for example, the care of elderly people, of children, to make them into an industry, but also, for example, contributes enormously, for example, to making life colder and poorer. And naturally, this is a also a danger for the logic of capitalist society as a whole, but the single economic actors naturally have an interest to always push further with economical logic of value. So I quoted also the sentence that finally capitalism has become like a kind of ship where there is no longer fuel, and so they just strip the parts of the how do you call it, the deck of the ship to put it in to heat the ship and to still go on for a little while.
The mass shooting phenomenon, let's say the incel or the neat phenomenon in English, it's no employment, education, or training. This is a larger and larger subsection of the working class, especially youth in the United States and in Western Europe and even China as well now. There's something, you make the connection between the superfluidity of labor and the sort of negativity and the sort of subjective expression of that in this uselessness. One of the other things, of course, that characterizes this era is surplus populations. Without going too far into current events, there's something about perhaps the nihilism of the conflict happening in between Israel and Gaza right now that might perhaps be an expression of this superfluidity leading to a sort of subjective, violent outbreak. Would you make that connection? Is that too far of a connection to go? Or do you think that events over there are a reflection of what you're writing about in the book?
No, not at all. That is a very important point, which I also have to say also was the first thing which struck me when at the beginning of the 90s, I got across the theory, the critique of value. since for all kind of Marxism, the central concept was always exploitation. But exploitation means that the capital needs labor and has to be in some kind of negotiation with the labor. But this historically has changed since the substitution of living labor, that's what Marx calls dead labor, the technologies, has taken such a development, especially since the 60s, that we are no longer in the presence of what Marx called the industrial army of reserve. Since now it is something structural that is first in the developed countries and now also in the rest of the world, capital needs very little labor force to continue. But what to do with the other people? So more and more the rest of the population got superfluous, since they cannot be employed in a profitable way in set to work. But they also, if they don't earn money, they are no consumer on the long run. And that means that maybe today the principal problem which is put by capitalism is not only exploitation, because if you are exploited, at least you can survive because capital needs you in some way. But if you are superfluous, so that means capital has no interest in you, and if you live or die, it has absolutely no meaning. And that means from the point of view of capital, there are just too many people. That means that whole countries or even whole continents would do better by disappearing from the scene. So that means there is a growing conflict between the existence of capital. I say really capital, I don't say the capitalist class, but capital is a kind of social logic on the one hand, in human life. So capital more and more tends to reproduce itself without and against humanity.
I have a thought that I wonder if Anselm could speak a little bit more to, just shifting back to the question of narcissism and all the particular pathologies involved in the way in which it's broadly examined in the book. Anselm, you go through a sort of series of particular pathologies, or not even pathologies, but maybe just social phenomena like de-symbolization, de-metaphorization, infantilization. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how, what these sort of categories mean and then how it is that they relate to this crisis of subjectivity. I think this was a very, very valuable portion of the book.
So as you see in this book, I finally tried to confront myself with many big, big subjects. And another question is the question of what the relation between human drives and desires and repression. So the question about the presence of parts of human life which are normally considered as unpleasant, as for example aggressivity or violence against others. So we have now, since centuries, we have the discussion in the European thinking between Hobbes, so between the idea that the human being is a wolf for another one, and Rousseau, and that only society makes us bad. So I just try to shed some light on this discussion by saying naturally, so we don't have decided that we can also admit that there are probably something like a very aggressive human nature, but all societies have developed mechanisms to control that, and especially by creating a world of symbolism, which gives a kind of shape and helps also human beings to control their aggressive or negative drives. And naturally, these social forms can naturally be very different, can be also very repressive, but other times it is also some kind of useful compromises, as for example what is called sublimation in psychoanalysis. And she also tried to point out that the development of the last decades largely destroy these kind of symbolic ways, and all the barriers which civilizations have constructed against, for example, the violent desires which are often existent in childhood. So, for example, normally education has always been putting some restraint on children, teaching them to control their own desires and drives. Now, in the last decades, we often see exactly the contrary. For example, consumption culture and the competition between commodities often push people to think they can obtain everything. It's just necessary to buy. that also means that all these kind of traditional systems of mediating one's own desires by symbolic structures, or also, or for example, by long-term thinking, is more and more or less considered archaic and is substituted by a culture of to have everything immediately. And in this on this level, Doc, there, I think Christopher Nash showed it very well. The logic of capital has been greatly helped by a part of the culture of the 60s and 70s and so on, of the kind of liberation of individual liberation, which wanted to throw away finally all the traditional structure, social and mental structures, but which finally greatly contribute to find a more pervasive state of capitalism.
And I was talking to a therapist recently about narcissism, and they often will say that it's one of the hardest things to treat, like a clinical narcissist. And so in the last chapter of the book, you talk a bit about this concept of the bad subject, the narcissistic subject. And if it is becoming such a generalized phenomenon as a result of the colonization of everyday life by the commodity, how do we break out of this? Like, it strikes me that even the concept of solidarity is becoming increasingly impossible. And so what kind of approaches do we come out of this, this tension between the sort of the liberating forces of the post-68 economy and social structure and the deepening atomization and narcissism that we find ourselves in?
So if we go back to Freud, so we see that Freud was, as I said, was mainly concerned with neurosis, which derived from the Oedipal complex. It means that the Oedipal complex, the child, finds a hard opposition to its desires. Naturally, what Freud described as the boy's attraction to the mother and his conflict with her father was just a part of a much bigger issue of repression of infantile desires. It's not necessarily linked to the bourgeois family, which Freud described. And this process is, even if it is at the origin of the repression of desires, is also which structures the personalities and which also teaches the children to replace their immediate desires with other more mediated or symbolic desires, and to turn themselves to real satisfaction in the world and to abide to the principle of reality, which, as Freud always said, is at the end always at the service of the pleasure principle. And Freud dedicated him not very much space to narcissism, and since it seemed to him a quite marginal phenomenon, which he found more close to psychosis. But in the last decades, more or less from the 70s on, most psychoanalysts found that traditional neurosis, which stems from the Oedipus complex, are much less important than narcissism. We have to say that it is quite difficult to define what might be understood as narcissism. And it is true that there are different psychologists and psychoanalysts give very different versions of it. But more or less, as on a common level, we can say that narcissism is something which origins at a much earlier age of the Oedipus complex. And it means that the child finally finds nothing that really is an obstacle to its desires. And so the child in his imagination is absolutely the master of the world. And even if naturally, normally the child or the individual, after he finds limit in the world, he always stays with his infantile desires of omnipotence, which also often leads to some kind of what is called narcissistic rage. So an impossibility of sublimating the frustration in front of a world which does not yield to our desires. And so, and for example, just to return to school shooting is just an extreme form of that kind of narcissistic rage.
And what's the difference in your book between rage and resentment?
Resentment is at the origin of rage. The narcissistic personality let's say in the always in the classic the classical or typical construction, the child is finally obliged to acknowledge the existence of something which is stronger as a child. So he learns to get some real but limited satisfaction from the world. The development of the narcissistic stops even earlier, and the narcissistic personality can make naturally, if he's not completely psychotic, he has to arrange his or her behavings to take into account the outer world, but there is no internal acknowledgement of that. The outer world is always seen really as a kind of enlargement of its own inner world, as it is typical for the very small child. This kind of fusion with the world and the fear of separation, the refusal of separation, which in the classical version, the separation is accepted in the issue of a typical conflict. The narcissist, unconscious level, never accept the separation from the maternal figure and from the outer world. It also means the narcissistic has no real internal acknowledgement of the existence of an outer world. That means this outer world is indifferentiated. Everything is the same. And this is a link to resentment. What is the difference between resentment and some of racial hate? You can naturally hate somebody who really have you done some evil. For example, in the classical form, the worker can hate, for example, his boss. But the resentment is a kind of rage which can very easily shift from one thing to the other one. Of hate, which may be the consequences of your labor conditions, you can put it against, for example, against migrants, or you can put it against women, or you can put it against. This is also the origin, for example, normally of fascistic personalities. The rage may have an understandable origin in your conditions of life, but is directed about something completely different. This is why resentment is so widespread today, since it permits to direct the rage, which in itself is not wrong, of individuals against something which has nothing to do with it. And so that means resentment is also finally helps very much the continuation of the system in that way, since resentment is more or less blind to which object. And I think it is quite absurd if, for example, thinkers like Slavoj Žižek even want to rehabilitate resentment as a kind of revolutionary force.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting the way that you connected this kind of populist resentment, this like ever-changing enemy that, for example, a figure like Trump can harness so well, where, you know, one moment he's talking about Mexican immigrants, yes, the next moment he's talking about Muslim people, the next moment he's talking about communists and Antifa, and then he'll just cycle back and forth, and the his followers will more or less go along with it as if they've totally forgotten which enemy they were supposed to be upset about like a month prior. And you connect this with the ultimate historical narcissist, who is Hitler, who in a quest for world domination saw that, well, if the German people aren't able to win this war, then they've failed me. And so he takes his death drive to a global level. I was so struck by that separation between resentment and rage as a political motivator. And it reminded me of these debates that I've seen recently online about Nietzsche in leftist circles, where there's sort of this orthodox Marxist position that Nietzsche, in his criticism of resentment, it's a sort of a anti-communist or anti-class struggle point of view, because if workers aren't allowed to have resentment against the capitalist class or are criticized in having that resentment, then they're essentially not able to fight it. I mean, would rage at the capitalist, like a non-moralistic rage against the capitalist process, be a more effective way of thinking about class struggle instead of like a resentment against your boss or the capitalist class?
So what, for example, people like Nietzsche, they often condemn the resentment generally without seeing that normally the root of the resentment might be also very understandable. It is the object which is wrong. That is also why in my book I also recall that one of the first history by the writer Jorge Luis Borges, if you remember that, which speaks about the daughter of the worker who is, in the beginning of the last century, who shoots himself after losing his labor. And so his daughter, she goes to the boss of her father. First, she prostitutes herself for the first time in her life. And when she goes into the office, the boss of their father, and she shoots him. And when the police came, she tells that the boss wanted to violate her. And Borges, he just ends his story by saying, the whole history was true. All her feelings, all her despair was true. It was just some details which were not true. And I think even that history, which also seems to be inspired by something which Emma Goldman writes, naturally, you can even say it is for a good sake that this shifting of feelings is used. But it well depicts this kind of substitute objects for feelings which are not wrong in themselves.
I think as we get close to the end, perhaps we should talk about how you leave your book in the epilogue and the appendix. You argue that the current crisis that we're living through isn't another of the series of cyclical crises of accumulation that have typified capitalist production since the very beginning, but instead this is a terminal crisis, and that the subjectivity that's reflected in that is part of the sort of inner boundary of capitalist development, an internal barrier to capitalist development itself, which is resolving itself in the end of this system. Talk a little bit about the finality of this, and talk a little bit about how the self-devouring society reflects the impasse that humanity is at right now under capital.
Yes, so as I told you, the capitalist, more or less until maybe the 1960s, was an expansion, extended itself to other parts of society and to new countries. It could also give some satisfaction, especially with the class compromise of the Keynesian area. But since the 70s, in reality, value production has become much more difficult, especially due to the substitution of living labor technologies. And as Marx has shown, technologies do not really create value and the long does not create profit. That means since the 70s, capitalism is really shrinking and can only survive by the expansion of financial markets. So this is also shown by the fact that since the 70s, financial markets has grown at least five times more than what might be called the real production. But that does not mean that financial sphere is some kind of parasite, which we could just cut to go back to real production. But it means that real production has no longer sense in the capitalist sense of term. It does not permit anymore sufficient accumulation of profit. And the profit is now largely simulated in with the financial sphere. And so that means capitalism already since some decades is really obsolete by its own criteria, but continues by a kind of, you could call it, by a kind of cheating, by a kind of simulation with the financial sphere. And so that does not mean that capitalism will come to an end by one day or the other, but there is a kind of growing impossibility to continue the situation as is marked, especially by the ever-growing debt of states and of private. So, and even many bourgeois analysts say that a very big financial crisis cannot be avoided in the next future. But after that financial crisis, there will not be a return to something like a more sane economy, but it will be shown that the capitalist economy was already not at all profitable for capitalists themselves. And that means that capitalism is in a declining phase in some decades. The fact that naturally some capitalist actors still make huge profits explains itself mainly as also by the concentration capital in always a fewer hands, but does not mean at all that capitalism in itself is always in good health. But what is worrying is that since naturally in the beginning the capitalist logic of production of living was always in a certain manner imposed itself on populations which also had different ways of living, different moral values, which had also the possibility of construct other ways of life after, for example, an eventual end of capitalism. normally the historical conflicts were especially strong when capitalism was just introducing itself in other kind of societies, for example in Russia in the beginning of the century, or in Spain in the 30s. But what is worrying that capitalism, lasting much more than could be expected, also had the possibility to profoundly shape the psychic structures of more or less all the inhabitants of the world. And in that way, also making it always more difficult to imagine other ways of living. And this can also be seen in the details. For example, we are so much accustomed now to comfort, for example, to the comfort of an individual living and to material comfort, as for example, in individual means of transport, always well-heated houses, foodstuff from all over the world, all over the year, and so that one of the main reasons, I think, which make it so difficult to imagine an alternative of capitalism is that it had to pick up extremely difficult for more or less the whole population to renounce to the kind of comfort which commodities give us.
Well, so what's the hope at the end of the book? Is it possible to have a union of narcissists, to have a party of narcissists somehow to overcome? Where do you find hope and optimism, if you have any?
Fortunately, we are not all completely narcissists. So narcissism, it is not a question if you are a narcissist or not, but maybe it your kind of level of narcissism, which can naturally be extremely high in people like Trump, which you could naturally never cure. But I think there are also still a lot of people in which a narcissistic tendency could also be stopped. For me, especially the pandemic, especially the first month, showed that it is still possible to invert a tendency. Since in the first moment of the pandemic, naturally there was no leaving behind capitalism, but just a little reducing the economic activities, reducing the work, and going back, for example, to help between neighbors and so, just showed that there is still some potential to constructing another world, especially also on the ecological level. The pandemic also showed that the damages which we have done to nature are still not completely irreversible.
With that, on that note, that light note of optimism, Anselm, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a fascinating and great conversation.
Thank you much for hosting me. Yes.
Of course. And the last thing we'll say before we sign off, everybody, is if you're not yet a supporter of this show, you can support us at patreon.com/theantifada. In the meantime, too, Eric John Russell has out now, I believe, volume 3 of Cured Quail. Not now, but soon.
Soon.
He's shaking his head.
Yeah, no.
Soon.
No. This spring. I mean, right now we're soliciting pre-orders for it to pay for the printing. So, it would be great if people could sign up for that. It's a really, really nice collection, the third volume. Anselm has a piece in there on the critique of concrete in modern architecture. There's a great piece, a critique of liberalism and nationalism today. There's another article on the critique of techno music that should be pretty provocative.
Finally, someone's taking techno down.
Yeah, our good friend Jacob Blumenfeld has a wonderful essay in there on what it means to manage decline and whether or not there might be something utopian in that sort of miserable process.
Anarcho-Bidenism.
And then there's a bunch of, it's a large volume. There's also an essay on the concept of use value fetishism, right? So moving away from this idea that use and exchange are these sort of absolute opposite poles, there's a way in which use value is internal to the production of exchange value. So there's a wonderful essay in there examining what it means to fetishize use and the concrete there. So it's an eclectic collection. So if people could place their pre-orders for that so we could go to print, that'd be dope.
We'll put a link to that in the show notes, and also, of course, plan to have Eric John on when that drops to discuss it. The last thing we must announce is if you've been hearing rumblings of our new group, if you're not in the New York area and haven't been around, we are having our big coming out party, and we're doing it on May 1st, which is a Wednesday this year. So watch this space.
So you better get this party started.
We want the world to know. So stay tuned for the Independent Labor Club of New York big May Day extravaganza. We'll be talking about it a bunch on the show in the lead up to that. All of that said, thanks again, everybody, for listening. Thanks again, Ansel, for coming on, and Eric John Russell. And we will talk to all of you soon.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.